doing this morning, Pierre?
Good morning, Jay. I'm doing fine. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Pierre.
All right, Pierre, I don't know whether you had heard the news before, whether you're waking up to it, because it certainly hadn't leaked out before this morning, but what's your reaction to your longtime colleague calling it a career?
I worked 15 years with Doc. Did the Olympics in Torino, did the Olympics in Vancouver, did the Olympics in Sochi. I'll never forget getting off the plane in Sochi with Doc. And just walking through town, and this was probably 7 or 8 days before the Olympic flow had actually started in Sochi, and we were walking around, and it was so hard to believe that there was going to actually be an Olympics there. Did the Summer Olympics with them in London, too. So we did a lot of different events in a lot of different countries around the world, and the one thing that always stands out about Doc is professionalism, probably the most prepared man I've ever seen in anything that you could ever imagine. Such a thorough reader and somebody that really took a lot of pride in making sure he got the story right. Rather than get it first, he wanted to get the story right. And, you know, it's one of those things where you get tired of fast food, you get tired of late nights, you get tired of long plane rides, and you just want to spend some time at home. And he and his wife, Joyce, have a tremendous life together. And they have a beautiful animal farm up in Michigan, in Port Huron, and I'm sure he wants to spend more time around his family and probably watching a lot of baseball.
It must have been interesting for him, Pierre, that time early on around Lou Lamoriello. Had to be a great pro and a professional. Were they almost a marriage as far as broadcaster and general manager?
I would imagine. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time back then with Doc. When I first started working with Doc, it was 2005. And I'll never forget the first show we ever did was in Detroit. It was a rehearsal show, believe it or not. It wasn't even going on the air. And he had to hurry back to get to a Devils game because Lou needed him there. But to take you behind the scenes, I'll never forget there was a huge night. It might have been for a number retiring in New Jersey. I forget. But Doc had to host it. And then we had a game the next afternoon, Detroit, Colorado, in Colorado. And right after the game, the Devils, under Lou Lamoriello's watch, got Doc on a private plane and flew him out there so he could get there in time to do the game in Colorado. And it showed to what Sean's talking about, the relationship between the two men, because Lou desperately wanted him to be at that number retirement and then not to miss his NBC job. So Lou took care of the private plane, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I agree. It was always just that kind of how difficult it was at the time. Also, on a national level, not just NBC, but certainly has done a ton for USA Hockey as well. Is he not, Pierre?
Oh, yeah. It's women's hockey, youth hockey, the Silver Stick in Port Huron, which is a great youth hockey event. Doc's always around it, always sending me updates on all the good young players. He fancied himself a bit of a scout, too. But he's done so much for USA Hockey, and he's done a lot for hockey all over. I mean, I can tell you one thing. We did the women's gold medal game in Torino, the women's gold medal game in Vancouver, the women's gold medal game in Sochi, which is one of the best games ever played. It was phenomenal. And he wasn't in Pyeongchang when I did it with Kenny Albert, but his passion for the women's game on both sides of the border, Canada and the United States in particular, phenomenal, phenomenal. He had just as much respect for the Canadian women that played as he did for the American women that played, just because he reveled in the level of competition that both countries presented. Women's hockey, when Canada and the United States play, is just off the charts to watch. It's just fantastic, and Doc added a certain element to it that made it even more special.
During your career, both at TSN and now at NBC for the past 15 years or so, you've had the, I'm sure, great pleasure of working with a lot of great play-by-play guys over the years. But for a lot of it, Pierre, almost all of it, you've been between the benches. So you don't have that kind of physical kind of, you know, eye contact where you can kind of, you know, do that back and forth where you can look at each other and know when you want to talk. So what makes working with Doc unique to anybody else you might have worked with in terms of that part of it?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question, JR. One of the things that Doc figured out early on is he was going to have to change his cadence a little bit to go with this new formula of broadcasting that NBC, led by Dick Ebersol and Sam Flood, really wanted to present. Ken Chancer was part of it as well back in the early days. And so Doc warmed to the idea right away, and he had to change his cadence just a little bit to allow for another voice to come up into the broadcast from between the benches. So he's the one that really made the adjustment and the sacrifice, and he made it work for everybody. But it's a great question, because there is none of that eye contact. You know, probably the announcer that I did the most games with when we were eyeball to eyeball was Gord Miller in the early days of TSN when, you know, I started there in 2000. And we would, you know, do so many games together, World Junior, you know, international events, obviously NHL games. And so I didn't get between the benches for TSN until probably 06, 07. So really it was Doc that kind of started the whole thing with between the benches. And now obviously that's become a standard operating procedure for most NHL broadcasts around the North America anyways.
All right, let's talk about what happened over the weekend. We'll start with certainly in Canada, what got the most headlines, because anything involving Toronto gets the most headlines, if not Montreal. But Joe Thornton, all the way back to Friday, Joe Thornton ends up signing a one-year deal with the Toronto Maple Leafs, $700,000, so it's the minimum deal. There's really no risk as far as the cash goes. But at the end of the day, do you think that Joe Thornton can be a positive signing for the Maple Leafs?
Well, I think he helps him on the power play. I think he helps him with a little bit of depth offense. Not so much that Joe's going to score, because I think those scoring days are gone for Joe, but I think he can set people up and help make people better that way. It's not going to be a lot off the rush. It's going to be more off the cycle with Joe, and that's usually how most depth offense is manufactured. But I think where he helps him a lot is probably on the second power play. And his playmaking skills are still pretty apparent, I can tell you that. I do a lot of San Jose games, and Joe's always been highly committed. You know, the most underappreciated part about Joe Thornton is his passion for the game and the amount of time he spends at the rink. He's there really early, and he is working at it really early. So I think he can help him. I don't think he can help him for more than 1 year, but I do think he can help him.
Guys at the rink early, Pierre, is always the son. They have young kids. They're always the ones to arrive first and leave last.
That's a good urban legend, but it's good.
It's true. Okay, just swaying one way or another, but from Simmons to Spezza to now Thornton, and I know financially not a big deal, especially on Spezza and Thornton, but do you like the makeup of those three players for where they're at and for where the Leafs are at as a team?
I think what they're trying to do is close the gap in 1 year, because I think there's a lot of pressure on them to win and to produce. They saw what happened this year and they weren't able to do that, and they saw what happened the previous 2 years and they weren't able to do that against Boston. I think they're kind of taking a page out of the Bruins playbook from back then, a little bit of the page out of the St. Louis Blues playbook. I think what they're trying to do, even a little bit out of Tampa, you know, by going out and getting Goodrow and Coleman and Maroon, I think they're looking for a different component. It's not just about slick, flashy, puck-handling guys. They're trying to get a little bit more grit and a little bit more sandpaper. We talked about it, you know, when Toronto moved Kadri and when Toronto moved Connor Brown. It was going to make things different for them, and you saw how much they struggled without Zach Hyman. They get Hyman back, and it makes a difference. So I think what they've tried to do in a real financially digestible way is to try to make their team a little bit harder to play against grit-wise. We'll see whether it works or not, but I respect the fact that they realized that their plan, their initial plan, was probably a bit flawed.
Is this also potentially, Pierre, not necessarily a message, but a sign that the general manager, the people in charge, the coach, just aren't happy with where the young guys are at as far as leadership goes, that they need guys still to lead them at this point?
That part I don't know, just because that's just sheer speculation.
Yep.
I'm sure people would speculate on that. I'm not in their room enough to know that. But I would say that you bring in those kinds of older voices that have had a wealth of experience and are known for being extremely competitive, that usually says that you're trying to bring a different element to your room and to the ice. But I would agree with a lot of what you just said, but I just don't know that for sure.
Yeah, I don't feel that with Spezza or Tavares, but in the case of Thornton coming in, is this maybe to get in the face a little bit of the Nylanders, Mariners, and even Matthews, if done the right way? But
you're
at least some
Joe?
Yeah.
Joe doesn't, like, I'm not going to drop names, but Joe really doesn't do it that way. You know, I do a lot of their games. I'm down there. And in San Jose, it's a unique bench position for the broadcaster, because you're basically, it's a lot like Colorado. You're right on their bench. You're part of it. You're part of the action. And there's no glass dividing you from their bench. So you can hear the things that are being said amongst the coach to the players or amongst the players to one another. Joe doesn't do that. If a guy makes a mistake, he'll whisper something, you know, and say, maybe you can do this, maybe you can do that. Or if a guy takes a bad penalty, he might say somebody's not going to be demonstrative and loud and verbose and dominating that way. That's not his style. He's more of, he's going to put his arm around you and say, okay, you know, maybe we can try it this way. So it depends on how you view things. But I don't think Joe will be like the most demonstrative, loud, mean-spirited person when it comes to that.
So as Joe Thornton goes to Toronto, Cody Ceci leaves. He gets a one-year deal with the Pittsburgh Penguins. Certainly a big pay cut down to $1.25 million. Is this a chance just for him to kind of try to get his game back together, get out from underneath the spotlight of playing hockey in Canada, and try to kind of rehabilitate his career? And what do you think he means to the Penguins back on the defense as well?
Well, first of all, he needs to be more consistent as a player and consistently good and utilize his skating for a man his size. He's a tremendous skater and get better with his decision-making, in particular with the puck, I think, more than anything else. That will help him. People that think that just getting out of Canada is going to help him, I would say ask Jack Johnson how easy it is to play in Pittsburgh. It's not. And Jack is Exhibit A, and believe me, he was plugged in right to the top level of the organization with his relationship with Sidney Crosby going back to when they played at Shattuck St. Mary's. Jack's no longer there, and he's now with the New York Rangers. So it's not an easy place to play if you're a defenseman that doesn't play a certain way. And the good news is that there's an internal relationship there with Mike Matheson. They played in the World Championships together. Mike came up from Florida. So that's going to help him. Obviously, he knows Kasperi Kapanen. That's going to help him. I think that one of the big things is Todd Reirden coming in there as an assistant coach. I watched what he did with Matt Niskanen, who was just a beaten-down puppy dog when he got to Pittsburgh from Dallas. And Todd really rehabilitated Matty Niskanen's career, and I think he can do a lot of the same for Cody Ceci. That's just the way that Todd is and the way he works with players. As an assistant coach, I think he's in a perfect role there. So I think there's a lot that's positive for Cody going into this. I really do. Pittsburgh had to sign somebody like that. They're just not deep enough internally. They've had some difficulty with the draft just because so many of their picks have been traded away to get established players to try to make those cup runs, which they were able to make. So their development plan is a little behind. So that helps. There's an opening for him, and he's cap-friendly at that number. He's very cap-friendly, and Pittsburgh needs that.
Yeah, we'll find out whether it's pressure or lack of hockey sense. When you look at what Pittsburgh's done, the addition of CeCe to Matheson to bring in Nylander, do you like what Jimmy Rutherford has done so far?
Well, I don't think that there wasn't a lot.
Kapanen, sorry.
Yeah, Kapanen. It's okay. I know what you're saying. There wasn't a lot where they could go, Sean, when you think about it, just again because of the salary cap. And so they needed to focus in on where they could be. And I can just tell you this with a real high level of comfort. The big thing is with Pittsburgh, as long as Crosby and Malkin are there and Letang, they think as an ownership group and as a management team, they're legitimate candidates to win the cup. Now, both Malkin, who was born in 86, and Crosby, who was born in 87, aren't getting any younger. And that's something that they're very well aware of. So they're trying to keep this thing relevant as long as they can while they have those two star players up front. And with Letang, he just got it, you know, more than anything else, born the same year as Crosby, keep him healthy in 87. So you got to keep him healthy. And I think that's, again, big things for the Penguins. And so they're trying to get as many competent NHL players as they can around those players.
Matty Grzelcyk re-signed with the Bruins. He was scheduled for arbitration this week. It's a four-year deal worth just a little bit less than $4 million per year. At this point, with Chara unsigned and Torrey Krug having left in free agency, he's the lone wolf back on left defense. If the Bruins don't decide to go with Chara, what are they going to do on defense, Pierre?
It's a great question. I think the biggest thing is, and I talked to a friend of mine who's obviously a big NHL person about this, and one of the things that really stands out about Boston is, the team, the better players are not getting younger, they're getting older, but one of the things they can do, they've got a very good player that doesn't get enough credit in Jeremy Lauzon. He's a left-shot defenseman. He can move over to the right. Johnny Moore is a lefty, and he can really skate. Juho Vakanainen is a lefty, and he can play. So they've got players internally that can move over and play on the left. The biggest thing about Matt, and I talked to you guys about this last week because we were talking about the Bruins' power play, especially without Pastrnak and without Marchand to start the year whenever we come back because of off-season surgeries that are pretty substantial. Grzelcyk and McAvoy played together at Boston University, and they ran just a lethal power play there. Now, the Bruins have tried that. during the regular season in Boston, and it's worked a little bit with both those guys back there. So it's not like it's a foreign concept for either guy. So it's something to pay attention to.
And you look at that with Krug walking out on a power play side. Do you also just look at this kind of internally, Pierre? Some drafting, and certainly that 2015, three picks in a row, only hitting on one, is starting to catch up with the Bruins?
Well, okay, to put it into perspective, Jacob Savoril was the first player picked with that. Jake DeBrusk was the second, and Zach Sinishin was the third. And if you look at the players that were missed, one of them that's playing in Ottawa very well, Thomas Chabot, one of them's playing with the Islanders, Matt Barzal. I mean, you can go back and dissect that. They missed on two of the three players. Zaboral's yet to play really in the league, and Sinishin, we don't know whether he will play in the league or not. But I know that the Bruins missed on that, you know, that draft in particular. Could you imagine where they'd be if Barzal was there and if, you know, Chabot was there? So it's, you know, it's pretty substantial when you look at it, because it's not like they were 10 picks away. They were right in the neighborhood, and the Bruins missed, and they had three in a row. So, yes, I think you can kind of trace back to that draft in particular. It wasn't overly strong for them, but there have been some other picks that have worked out really well and some other trades that have worked out very, very well for them.
Zaboral's on a one-way contract now, which is interesting because right. He's been mostly playing down in the minors. Right. So you think of all the scouting misses, though, Pierre. That one of Zaboral and Chabot, they played together.
That is
the most mind-boggling one to me. Like, it's one thing when you're going to a rink one, okay, and you're seeing he's with the team X, and then the guy's out in the Western League, and okay, well, we missed on that one because within the team structure, it just wasn't the same. Like, they literally played together, and they missed on that one.
Well, they did. And there's no question, and that's, I know internally that's been something that they've tried to break down and figure out how'd that happen. And, you know, they're not going to tell the public, but it's something that internally you have to pay attention to. I mean, there's no question. And so you can trace it back. And Sean knows, he's probably been part of these meetings where, you know, you look at a scout in his area and who's gotten players that have played and who's missed on players that they've either told us to select and we've selected or haven't told us to select and have gone on and played really well. So you do a debrief after every draft, and you know, usually it's 2 or 3 years after the fact, but you definitely do debriefs. There's no question about it.
Do you look what the since director of scouting, Trent Mann, is a Maritimer. I think he lives somewhere in New Brunswick. And certainly the Sens have had a little bit of success. So Drake Batherson was, you know, through the draft once, yeah, played out of the Quebec League. They drafted this two-time overager Sokolov from Cape Breton. Do you think, it's not that chief scouts and scouts aren't on the road all the time, but you're home from time to time, and hey, I can drive and get to a game and come home. You just maybe see a few more games in your local area that maybe you develop just a little bit more of a know-how of the players in the area that you live as chief scout.
That's such a valid point. It's so 100% on. I'll give you a case in point. Go back to the 1990 draft and Keith Tkachuk. Keith Tkachuk didn't play his draft year. It's his 17- and 18-year-old year. He had a broken ankle. He didn't play. And the chief scout for the Winnipeg Jets at the time was Joe Iannetti, who is also the coach for the great Bobby Carpenter when he played at St. John's Prep in Danvers. Danvers in Connecticut, just up the road from me. But So anyways, so Joe Iannetti's a guy that had the inside information on Tkachuk. And what did he go, 17 or 18, I think, in the 90 draft? You have to look it up, but he's right in that neighborhood. Anyways, he turned out to be a star player, but if they don't have Joe Iannetti there, nobody's even talking about him because of the fact that they didn't know his body of work. He didn't play his draft year because of a broken ankle.
Is that also the case, Pierre, as you just kind of pointed out as well? Man's best intel is going to be where you live, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it goes to a completely different level of, hey, I'm getting it directly from the people I knew that I grew up with versus someone else.
Well, this is why my theory, and I've proposed this to so many different ownership groups over time, you know, when I've interviewed for these different jobs, and I'm a big believer, having scouted like Sean has, I really believe that you need to have scouts that are experts in their own area, and not enough scouts spend enough time getting enough intel in their area. So you got to decide what you find are vibrant areas where players, mucho players, are being developed. And that could be, you know, you may have a fondness for Ontario Hockey League players or Western Hockey League players or Minnesota high school players or Swedish-born defensemen or Finnish goalies, whatever it is. You have to have people that you trust that are going to be experts in their own area, and there's not going to be a lot of crossover travel. You might have 2 or 3 cross-checkers that go and do a lot of traveling, but your key decision-makers, I think, have to be in really vibrant hockey areas where they become experts in the areas. And that's where you steal players in the sixth and seventh round, even the fifth round. And if you're not doing that in today's NHL because of the cap, then you're doomed to fail. You are doomed to fail.
Yeah, and a lot of crossover can be done at tournaments. Is that why in the 90s we saw a lot of teams placing scouts right in Ann Arbor, close to the development program for the U.S.?
Huge, 100%. That was a huge part of it. The teams were really smart. I'll use Detroit as an example that had an amazing run. One of their key decision makers was Håkan Andersson, and they just left him. They could have brought him over many times to North America. They just left him in Sweden, and he worked Sweden, Finland, and Russia. And look at the Russians that they stole and the Swedes that they stole and the Finns that they got over time. I mean, just they did amazing work over there. But it's because they identified how vibrant those hockey areas were, in particular Sweden and Finland back then, and they were able to get a lot of players, you know, third, fourth, fifth round players that ended up being star players in the league. Zetterberg and Datsyuk are two good examples.
I want to close with the Sens made three, we'll say minor league signings at this stage, but the interesting one, Pierre, is goalie Joey Decord, who spent almost all last year in Belleville. Mm-hmm. He gets a three-year contract. The first 2 years are a two-way, and the third year is a full-time NHL one. Now, it's not big money, but the structure of it has me kind of thinking, and I know we got a Seattle expansion draft coming. Yeah. What is there something to the structure of that contract that you think has something to do with expansion? Does it have anything to do with where the Sens are looking at long-term with the goaltender? What do you think it means, a three-year contract like that?
Well, I think it has something to do with expansion. I also think it has something to do with where the Sens think his game will be. He's a kid coming out of Arizona State. We talked about him a couple of years ago. And, you know, obviously his dad's been a goalie coach around, so I think they're getting comfortable knowing his level of play and commitment to the game, and they probably saw a lot of that last year. So I think a lot of it comes down to where they think their development as an organization will be. They obviously have expansion coming, and he's a digestible number. So, I don't think it's a bad signing. I think it's probably really prudent. It's a lot like the Jake Allen signing. Everybody in Montreal is, why would they extend him when they have Caden Primo? Because they have an expansion draft coming, and they're going to expose Jake. That's what's going to happen. So, I mean, that's just pretty good standard operating procedure for a management team, I think.
All right, good stuff. Always appreciate the time and the insight, and we'll chat with you again tomorrow.
Wow. We're already into another week.
We are, and things are going to get a little bit, you know, we got a few unsigned guys, going to get a little bit quiet here for the next month or so, but fingers crossed that hopefully we'll get some good news on the hockey front over the next 6 weeks or so. We'll see on that.
Crazy. I got to share this with you. I know we talked about it last week, and I know we have to go. I am still amazed that Hoffman hasn't been signed. I know that there are a lot of people that wonder, you know, why am I saying that? Because I'm telling you, goals are at a premium in the league, and you can see it'd probably be on a short-term deal. And I just talked, before I came on with you guys, I was talking to somebody that works in the league that, you know, at a high hockey level. And nobody that I know in my circle of friends can believe that Sammy Vatanen hasn't been signed. It's really shocking. There must be something wrong out there, because that guy should have been signed a while ago.
Right. All right. Well, maybe today's the day. We'll find out.
See you later.
All right. See you, Pierre.
Bye.